This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
They used to be regular guests in our homes, anytime we chose, entertaining us when we switched on our radio and television sets. Now it's time to hear again the voices that came out of the glow.
Settle down for an hour of remembering? Yes, it's Steve Price and Paul Featherston all ready to play through some memories. There's a description of a boxing encounter, an encounter of a quite different sort with Groucho Marx, and we visit Margot at the Manor in amongst those memories. George Formby with his uke steps up to start with for a second appearance on Concert in the Groove and says, "You can't stop me from dreaming." This is especially for Les McPherson in Ashburton. "How are you doing?" "Well, as someone once said to me, Les, at least I'm still above ground." That has to be a plus point.
So sweet and lovely, but what an affair. Not even a kiss since we met. You just won't love me, but I don't care, for I will get you yet. You can stop me from kissing you. You can stop me from cuddling too. You can say, "No, no, honey, that's all right," but I'll get even with you tonight, 'cause you can't stop me from dreaming. You can stop me from holding hands. Make me listen to your commands. You can say, "No, no, honey, that's all right," but I'll get even with you tonight, 'cause you can't stop me from dreaming. From 1 o'clock till 9, I'll dream you're mine. I'll steal a kiss. Now look what you're gonna miss. You can stop me romancing you. You're the boss now, but I'm not through. You can turn me down, honey, that's all right, but I'll get even with you tonight, 'cause you can't stop me from dreaming. Teach you by hook or crew that you won't find in a kookery boo, 'cause you can't stop me from dreaming. I've just been on my holidays to Blackpool by the sea. Although I'm feeling mighty fit, him feet are troubling me. queued for hours and hours, but I must say it was grand to get as near as half a mile to several miles of sand. On Blackpool Prom on Saturday, I had a lovely time. I queued for breakfast, I queued for lunch, I queued for bananas in a bunch, I queued for a glass of bitter, the old woman was watching the pram. I queued for Beryl's gin and lime, it really was a pantomime. Before I got served they shouted time, so I queued for a queue with a tram. On Blackpool Prom on Saturday, oh what a lovely day. I queued for oysters, I queued for rock, I queued for a view of the town hall clock. I queued for the fun of queuing, and I murmured what I do. A game of snooker would be great, I queued to put me name on a slate. Then after 60 minutes wait, I queued in a queue for a queue. On Saturday, the women looked simply grand. I queued for the darkens, I queued for the fair, I queued for the chance to have me share. Oh boy, was I up and doing, and I murmured, I love you. A figure, it was like a dream, quite big at the front and broad at the beam, but it was the missus that I'd seen, so I flew from the queue, wouldn't you?
George Formby on Blackpool Prom. George's passion, as some of you might know, was motorcycles and expensive cars, which, of course, he could well afford. During World War II, he was giving Sunday evening radio talks, presumably ad-libbed. At his peak, he was turning out a record a month for Decca and Regal Zonophone. Here he is again with Oh Dear Mother.
I called round last night my best girl to see. Felt in such a plight when she sat on my knee. Oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, we shared the same chair too. She clung to me both hard and fast and thought her chance had come at last. But oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, I washed down her neck blue. It settled somewhere I could tell, she told me where it was as well. But oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Christening once I felt far from bold, when they gave to me the baby boy to hold. Oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, I wore my best suit too. They sprinkled water on his hair, there was water everywhere. But oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, an old woman who lived in a shoe. I called to see her kids galore, she'd said she'd room for a couple more. But oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, went in the bed with flu. A young girl felt my pulse, good lord, my temperature rose more and more. And oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, while bathing in the blue, some girls when I came out undressed took snapshots of my family crest. And oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do. Oh dear mother, well I didn't know what to do.
Our concert goer Chris McCabe will be back in a week, introducing in-concert recordings by the Coasters. How are you doing, Lorna and Wilf Metzger? Here is a great moment in US boxing history. Today it's Max Schmeling versus Joe Louis. Your narrator is Don Dunphy.
15 rounds for the World Heavyweight Championship. Weighing 193, wearing purple trunks, outstanding contender for heavyweight honors, the former heavyweight title holder, Max Schmeling.
My name is Don Dunphy. The sounds you just heard were the sounds of the prize ring. They were the actual sounds of perhaps the most dramatic opening minutes in modern boxing history. The scene, the Yankee Stadium in New York. The situation, the return bout between Max Schmeling, the great German heavyweight champion, and Joe Louis, the heavyweight champion of the world. Why were they here? 2 years before, in June of 1936, they met for the first time. Louis, the brown bomber from Detroit, was the heavy favorite.
And Louis was slow coming out of his corner trying to adjust the glove. He's a different Louis tonight, a great deal different. Now in the center of the ring, Louis standing there and feinting with his left hand. With his right, he is trying to cup off Schmeling's left hand. And Schmeling shot a hard right to the jaw, but Louis was inside of it, and it did very little damage. Schmeling got over two more hard rights to Louis's jaw and made Louis give ground. And there, Schmeling straightened up Louis with hard rights and left to the jaw. He has puffed up Louis's left cheek, and Louis is down. Louis is down, hanging to the rope, hanging badly. He is a very tired fighter. He is blinking his eyes, shaking his head. The count is done. The fight is over. The fight is over. And Schmeling is the winner. Louis is completely out.
So Schmeling knocked Louis out. It was one of the great upsets in boxing history. Schmeling went back to Germany. Louis kept on fighting here. A year later, he fought James J. Braddock for the championship of the world.
No doubt everybody will be wondering whether or not he'll be able to overcome the defeat that Schmeling gave him. I hope to do the same, if not better, as Schmeling did on the night that we meet.
Me boxer, the heavyweight champion of the world, James J. Braddock. Pounds. His challenger from Detroit, Joe Louis.
Rogue Mail, the Jeffrey Household novel about one man's pursuit of another man, remains a favourite book of mine. This is the first episode of an Australian serial of the novel. Hello to Jim Smart in Papanui and Bob Gant of Church Corner. Hope you both enjoy the episode.
I'd hunted all kinds of big game in my time. But it wasn't until I hunted a man, the most dangerous game of all, that I learned what it meant to be hunted in my turn, to become that outcast creature we call a rogue male. Come to think of it, If only I'd been just a little less sporting about the whole thing, we might never have had the Second World War. Oh, yes, it was as simple as that. Not that this is in any way a war story. As a matter of fact, it all took place before the war. For a long time, I was neither permitted nor did I wish to talk about this strange affair to anyone. But there were those who knew about it. My wife Phyllis, for one, though she wasn't my wife at the time.
I'm not so sure I want to be your wife if you persist in going ahead with this crazy idea.
You know, Phyllis could be right about this, Dick. I mean, is it really worth the risk?
My loyal friend and fellow big game hunter Archie Devereaux. That stopped me for a moment. After all, Devereaux and I had been together in some pretty tight spots. And when he started to weigh the risks... But I'm getting ahead of my story.
From world-ranking British author Geoffrey Household comes Rogue Mail, a romantic drama of high adventure, low treachery, and desperate cunning.
It was an autumn evening in 1939. We were sharing a couple of comfortable leather armchairs in the London branch of the Explorers Club, Archie and I. He'd just ordered a brace of drinks when the door swung open and in walked Janos Marco. Looking back, I'd say that's where it all began.
I say, isn't that Janos Marco?
Why, yes, so it is. Haven't seen him for 6 months or more. Janos, over here.
Dick Thorndike. Oh, a pleasure it is to see you again, my friend. A great pleasure.
Well, that goes both ways. How are you? Oh, you remember Archie Devereaux, of course.
But certainly. How are you, Devereaux?
Oh, same old me, you know. How was Europe? I presume that's where you've been.
Europe? A sad place to be these days for those who love freedom.
No, I expect it is. Hope they haven't ruined the hunting, though.
I did not go to hunt, not this time.
How's your lovely wife?
Elsa. Oh, you would not know, of course.
Know what?
This trip of ours, it was Ilse's idea. She had some friends in Germany. She wanted to help them get out.
Ah, I see.
And now she's dead.
What? Janos, how on
the
earth...
The Nazis caught her. Of course, her friends were anti-Nazis, so she was shot.
Oh, the filthy murdering... Oh, it's hard to believe.
I remember her so clearly. Such a lovely face.
Naturally, without her, suddenly life is nothing for me, you understand.
Yes, of course.
Hitler, he's the one who should be shot.
I agree, it's a fiend, the devil.
I'd like to have the blighter in my sights for just 2 seconds. I'd soon make an end to Europe's troubles.
So would any one of us, Archie, but such a thing is not possible. And now, if you'll excuse me, I am expecting to meet someone in the map room.
Yes,
ma'am. Oh, yes. Oh, well, nothing much for it but to go to bed, I suppose. Pretty dreary ending to a pleasant evening, I must say.
Yes. Janos put rather a damper on things, I'm afraid.
Poor devil. He must feel pretty dreadful about his wife.
No doubt, but... The point is, he doesn't do anything about it.
Do? What can he do?
Now, so many of Hitler's enemies are the same. They talk and talk, but... They don't do anything.
That's all very well, old boy.
Janos is a crack shot. We both know that. Yet when you suggested shooting Hitler, he just shrugged the idea off as impossible.
Oh, well, I don't blame him. I didn't expect to be taken literally anyway. How could anyone get close enough to Earl Adolf?
Berchtesgaden would be the place. His mountain hideout in Bavaria. A high-powered rifle, a telescopic sight. Yes, why not?
What on earth are you dribbling about, Dick?
It could be done, you know.
What, shoot Hitler? Oh, come off it.
You want to bet?
Bet? Oh, don't be an ass, Dick.
You think I'm kidding?
Don't tell me you really want to go and shoot that blighter.
Oh, I'm not in the least. As a matter of fact, I don't have any particular feelings about Hitler at all, but I believe someone could shoot him. And I might even be prepared to prove it.
You must be off your rocker.
Look, I tell you what. Now, I told you I was thinking of buying that .338 Winchester, and you're thinking of investing in a new .25. Okay. Let's make a bet of it. With the rifles as the stakes.
Oh, come off it, Dick. I'd have to be off my head to make such a bet with you or anyone.
Well, you must admit it's a very interesting challenge. Why not think about it?
I wouldn't waste my time. Oh, drop you off at your flat?
Oh, yes, I suppose so. Ticket, I think.
Morning, darling. I wasn't sure you'd be up.
Hello, Phil. I say, you're looking very lovely. Some reason for the glad rags?
Oh, heavens, don't speak of it. It was a nightmare dressing today. Hey, don't I get a kiss?
Oh, actually, I was wondering how to manage it without ruining your makeup.
A man of your finesse. Oh, come now.
Will that do?
It'll have to. For the moment. Now, I have the most excruciating day ahead of me. Luncheon with the Flynns, you know, and then a perfectly wretched garden party at Martha's, and after that there's some kind of a cocktail thing at the French Embassy.
Well, how on earth did you let yourself in for all that?
Oh, I thought they were all on different days, of course. You know me, I never can remember dates.
Oh, well, that'll teach you, won't it?
The ghastly part of it all is that I'll have no time to change. And I ask you, how does one dress for lunch, a garden party, and cocktails? No, but this isn't any way to do it.
Well, you look marvellous, if that's any comfort.
Thank you, darling. You're sweet. What are you doing with that rifle in your hand?
Not this. Just selecting the right one for a little job.
Oh, don't tell me you're dashing off on some safari again.
Well...
Honestly, darling, every time I turn around, you're planning some hunt or other.
It isn't a hunt, not in the ordinary sense. It's a little bet I made with Archie.
Archie Devereaux?
Yes. Actually, he didn't want to make it, but I talked him into it. It's, it's not something we'd want to get around, you know.
For heaven's sake, stop being so mysterious and tell me.
You're all right, but remember, keep it to yourself.
The gall, the colossal gall, to tell me to keep it to myself. I tell you, Archie, I feel like telling all London. That would put an end to the whole thing.
That wouldn't do any good at all, Phil. Dick's so pig-headed. When he makes up his mind to a thing, that's it.
But I've never heard of such idiocy in all my life. Going to Germany to shoot Hitler, it's absolutely insane. Next thing you know...
Please, please, not so loud.
What?
There are all kinds of birds around here. You never know who might be listening.
Oh, I jolly well hope they are. If word gets out that Dick Thorndyke intends to go on this ridiculous trip, well, then he'll have to abandon the idea.
You don't understand. The Germans are here at this party in full force. They thought someone was going to try to... Well, I wouldn't like to be in Dick's shoes then.
Archie, what are you talking about?
People have been... liquidated for far less reason than that, you know.
Liquidated? No. You mean someone like killed Dick?
Well...
Archie, we've got to do something. I never thought anything like that could... We've got to stop Dick going ahead with this.
That's all very well, but how?
Hello?
Dick Thorndyke.
That's right. Who's...
It's Janos Mako here.
Janos?
Dick, I must see you privately where we can talk.
I see. When?
Immediately, if possible. It is most important.
Oh. Can you come over to my place? I'm alone here.
No, that will not do. I don't want to be seen going there.
You don't want to be... Janos, what the devil are you talking about?
Listen, please. I have not much time. Go to the Holborn Underground Station and wait on the platform for the westbound Piccadilly Tube. You understand?
The Holborn?
Yes, please, please.
All right, I've got that, Janos.
I will meet you there in exactly half an hour.
Janos, is there something
wrong? Sorry, I must go. Goodbye. Half an hour. And please, be there.
Well, that's almost peculiar, I must say. Exactly half an hour, he said.
Waiting for something, Mr. Thorndyke?
Who are you?
No, don't move.
What's
the idea? Let go of my arms.
Please don't struggle. My friend who has your other arm is very strong. I wouldn't want him to break anything.
Who the devil are you? What do you want?
Why, to see that you don't miss your train, of course. What else?
I don't know you, either of you.
Ah, but we know you, Mr. Thorndyke. And we must see that you catch that train. It'll be here any time now.
I'm not catching any train.
Oh, but you must. You might never have another chance to catch a train.
Look here, if you don't let me go,
A little closer to the edge of the platform, I think. That's better. Now, you can't possibly miss the train, can you? Ah, it comes now. You see, you can't miss the train, and the train can't miss you, Mr. Thorndyke, if we let you fall.
The train roared into the platform. It seemed to me that my last moment had come. Instead, this was just the first act in a strange drama in which I was to be transformed into that fearsome creature we call a rogue male.
Mary Wilson's poem for you today is called The Lifeboat. We hear the rocket from the slip. Fast, fast, we run to watch them go. Here in the dark, we only know that silly rock has claimed a ship. We see them as we cross the strand. The smiling boatmen from the quay, stern, oil-skinned strangers, seem to be passing the ropes from hand to hand. Old Matt looks on with wistful face. He's had his share of risks and fears, coxswain or crew, for 60 years, and now young Matt stands in his place. Now Dr. Bell climbs in the boat. The pulleys turn, the cable lift into the water, smooth and swift, one rush of spray, and she's afloat. Thank God there is no fog tonight, but tearing gale and streaming rain, no stars to guide her home again, only the steady harbour light. That's the last of Mary Wilson's poems, at least for this year. James Condon is here again to tell us about Pocahontas.
Parade! A cavalcade of people, places, and memorable events. Captain John Smith probably should be best remembered for his work as a pioneer of the first settlement of Englishmen in America at Jamestown in 1607, and for his subsequent exploration of what is now the state of Virginia. He certainly lived an extraordinary existence during this time, being constantly elected and promoted to positions of authority, only to find himself again and again threatened with death as a conspirator or for some other reason. He never seemed to be guilty of any of the crimes he was accused of, and always managed to talk his way out of trouble. However, one occasion when his eloquence failed him provides the story for which he is best known. Captain Smith and a party of men were ambushed one day in the woods. Some Indians were killed and the white men fled, leaving Smith to take refuge in a swamp. There he was captured, but the Indians were so fascinated with the compass he carried that they dubbed him a man of magic and hauled him before their chief.
I am Chief Powhatan. You are magic man.
I come in peace, O chief. I bring many gifts of axes and beads.
You are not magic man. You kill Indian braves. So, you die now.
Smith was seized and forced to place his head on a stone in front of the chief while an Indian brave prepared to club him to death. But suddenly...
Stop!
Who dares to defy Powhatan?
It is I, father, your daughter. Please, I beg you not to slay this man. Give him to me, to be my slave.
A pale face? But he is ugly and he has had much hair on his face.
I think he is beautiful. Please give him to me.
What my daughter asks, she have. Take the pale-faced Pocahontas.
Sir Curd, the incident now recalled by many a schoolchild who otherwise might find it hard to remember the name of Captain John Smith. Pocahontas, daughter of the Indian chief, saved his life, and he became her slave.
But I shall not force you to stay with me, Captain Smith. If you wish, you may return to your people.
She was to save his life on another occasion when Chief Powhatan planned to murder Smith at a so-called peacemaking powwow. Warned by Pocahontas, Smith once more escaped. One wonders how grateful he was to the girl and whether he ever contemplated marrying her. In actual fact, she did marry a white settler later, and Smith met her yet again when her husband brought her to England. There, the miserable climate of London brought about the death of the lovely Indian. As for Captain Smith, who should have died violently a score of times during his turbulent career, he confounded everybody by expiring peacefully in bed with his boots off. You have been listening to the dramatization of a true story from the pages of the National Monthly Magazine, Parade.
Out of the Globe is about melodies and moments from broadcasting history.
Ohio River, the Stoned Ranger.
This is Paul Featherston, inviting you to tune to an hour of comedy, featured artists, personalities, and sports coverage on Plains FM 96.9, the first two Sundays of the month at 5 p.m.
There's the dropout by Oxley. It won't go over the 25. He's trying to kick it along the line.
Groucho Marx took his nickname from his grouch bag, an attaché case he carried his equipment and props in. He hated and feared his father, who neglected him, and Groucho in turn ignored his own daughter, Miriam. The circle goes round and round, doesn't it? Groucho Marx is heard here on radio with Bing Crosby. With this, we say good day to John Newman of Burnside.
Life, L-I-F-E, is so peculiar. It gets so cold you turn blue. But then the next day could be sunny, so you get sunstroke or flu. When you're a helpless baby, there's nothing to do but cry.
And when you're finished living, there's nothing to do but die.
And in the years between time, there's nothing to ask but why.
Life is so peculiar, don't know why we even try. Life.
Son? Come over here and sit down on my knee. I want to explain to you about life.
Yes, Pappy.
My boy, someday you'll be going by a drugstore. There'll be a beautiful girl standing on the corner. She'll whistle at you. She may take you for a ride in her convertible. She'll invite you up to her apartment to look at her etchings. She'll offer you a drink. She may invite you to sit down in her chaise and lounge. She'll throw her arms around you. She'll hug you and she'll kiss you. And son, you're going to be frightened. You're going to be scared. And my boy, if you ever meet a woman like that...
Yes, Pappy?
Give me her phone number.
Meet a gentle maiden, she's Neptune, know.
So you take her to Niagara, where honeymoon couples go.
She's friendly with the room clerk, they've met seven times before.
Life is so peculiar, let's not bother anymore.
Not with her, at least. Life!
Give me the lowdown, Brother G.
It's so peculiar. It's caviar, or it's Sprite.
Yes, it's as fickle as can be.
Or life may give you a medal.
I've had my chest dripping with them.
Then slyly slip you the knife.
Oh, my aching back.
Life is so peculiar, but as everybody said, that life is so peculiar, but as everybody said, that life is so peculiar, but as everybody said, that's
It's episode 22 of The Serial.
Please, put your arms around me. Kiss me.
What?
Kiss me.
That's how it began. A foggy night, a lurking peril, and a lovely girl who was too young to die. These days, Inspector, you seem to spend half your time interviewing my wife.
If you spend more time at home, you'd realize it's not Mrs. Chester I come to see.
That's true, May. Mr. Charlton...
It happens I'm not really very interested. I don't intend to answer any of your idiotic questions either, Charlton. I want to know just one thing. What have you done with Jan Carter?
Done with her?
You didn't play dumb about it. She's disappeared.
Oh, where from?
You know where she was, at my flat down by the docks.
I thought you might take her there.
So you sent your bulldogs to get her last night after I'd left her there alone?
What makes you think that?
What the devil does that matter? If you must know, I made some inquiries. There are one or two nosy people living in Long End Street. A police car was seen outside my building late last night.
Ah, yes. Sergeant Ford, no doubt.
What have you done with her? If you think you can pin the murder of Blaney on her, you're crazy.
No, I don't think we can do that.
Then what have you picked her up for?
Who wants to know?
What?
You're Miss Carter's legal representative, perhaps?
Well, not exactly.
Her husband?
Oh, don't be ridiculous.
Supposing we have picked up a girl by the name of Jan Carter, what has it got to do with you? Now, I seem to remember that the last time I mentioned her name to you, you said you'd never heard of her.
Well, never mind that.
But I insist on minding that. Because if I don't, I have to decide whether I ought to arrest you, Mr. Chester.
A fat lot of good that'd do you.
I quite agree. I would much rather not arrest you.
You still haven't told me what you...
Right now, I am not going to tell you anything, Chester. And I suggest you stop and think before you ask any more stupid, thoughtless questions that will solve nothing, even if they're answered.
I thought I knew a lot about standard police procedure. Spent long enough as a police reporter when I was a kid.
But now you're finding out that police operations can be a little unusual, right?
I'm learning that some policemen can be unusual.
Well, so can some writers, Mr. Chester. So many of them write about life all the time but have no idea how to live it.
Are you two going to stand here insulting each other all day?
Oh, my apologies, Mrs. Chester. I'll be getting along. I thought of something I want to check on at headquarters.
Now, just a minute, we haven't finished.
Yes, we have, Mr. Chester, quite finished for the moment. But we'll talk again, I'm sure of that. Goodbye, Mr. Chester.
Goodbye, Inspector. Call again any time. I usually have tea at 11.
Oh, well, thank you. I shall be delighted. Two sugars?
What was that all about, Eve? What's the idea of getting chummy with that flatfoot?
Perhaps the Inspector had a point.
Had a point? About what?
About writers writing about life when they don't know how to live it. It never ceases to astonish me that you've been such a successful journalist when you seem to lack so much of a writer's equipment.
Such as?
A sense of irony, for one thing.
A newspaper reporter writes of facts. The only irony he needs is the irony that's already there.
Oh, perhaps that accounts for it. But in that case, Mike, you might as well give up trying to write your novel. I doubt if you're cut out for that.
I'm certainly not cut out for following the way your mind works. I asked you about the inspector, and now we're talking about irony.
Questions. Here's one for you, Mike. What about this Jan Carter?
I don't see any point in discussing her.
She was not part of our deal.
Our deal was that I would come back to live with you. I warned you that it mightn't work out. I haven't changed.
I paid you £1,000 when you came back to me, Mike. Don't you think I'm at least entitled to get something for my money?
You've got all you bargained for. I'm here. That's all I promised.
And £1,000? Well, you spent it already. I suppose, truth to tell, you gave it to... Yes, of course, that's it.
That's what?
You wanted that money for her. For Jan Carter.
So?
I just don't understand you, Mike. If we'd played cards for that money, you wouldn't have done it, not in a million years.
Done what?
You wouldn't have cheated.
Oh, Sergeant.
What? Oh, yes, sir, yes. I've been down here making the routine inquiries about Blaney, sir. Haven't come up with much, of course.
Well, it's what we expected. I thought I might as well pick you up. I think you're wasting your time here. And I wanted to talk to you.
What about, sir?
Get in.
Oh, righto.
Remember you told me you went looking for Michael Chester last night?
That's right. Down at his place near the docks.
You said you drew a blank.
Yes, sir. There was nobody home.
You went up to his flat?
Well, of course, sir. I told you I...
Yes, I just wanted to be sure you actually went to the flat.
Well, we didn't gain entry, of course. I knocked, that's all. Of course, there could have been someone inside. Always that possibility.
But you didn't see anybody?
No, sir. How could I?
And you saw nobody outside, in the street, or elsewhere in the building?
No, sir. You're surprised we didn't see anyone, sir?
No, just getting the record straight, Sergeant.
Ah.
Soft, like a blanket.
You came to me out of the fog, Jan. So I suppose I should like it too, and yet...
Yet what?
Perhaps it's the fog that makes you seem unreal. In the clear light of day, you've become a reality to me, instead of a dream.
Are you sure it's reality you want?
Yes, that's what I want. Maybe that's why I don't like the fog.
But I belong in the fog, Mike. You said yourself that's how I came to you. Perhaps I'm not real after all.
You are. You must be real for me.
I want to be. For the first time in my life, I want to be real to someone. I want to be real to you, Mike.
You are real. Believe that, Jan. Believe it.
Put your arms around me, Mike. Hold me close.
Oh, I'll never let you go. Jan? Jan, where are you? Jan! Jan, where are you? Jan, don't leave me. Don't go away, please. I need you. I can't see you, Jan. Jan! Jan, come back!
Mike, wake up! Mike!
What? Jan? Huh? Oh, Eve, I must have dozed off.
Some doze. You were having a nightmare.
What time is it?
It's nearly dinner time. I've been out all afternoon.
Yes, I remember. I just sat down here. I thought I'd read a while. I couldn't concentrate.
I'd say you were concentrating pretty effectively while you were asleep.
What do you mean?
You were calling her name.
Her? Jan?
How many hers are there in your life, Mike? Needless to say, it wasn't my name.
Oh, I don't know why I fell asleep.
Obviously, for the simple reason that you haven't been sleeping enough at night. And you always did have the capacity to fall asleep anywhere if you were tired. How many times did you snatch a wrist in the back of a jeep traveling over those shocking roads in Asia?
Well, I don't feel much benefit. My head feels terrible.
Yes, well, you're going to get one good night's rest tonight. That's a promise.
I'll be all right.
You will tomorrow. I'm going to get you something to eat, and you're going to bed with a sedative.
Well, there's no need to fuss.
There is every need to fuss. You're feeling pretty sorry for yourself because you've lost your girlfriend.
I don't want to talk about it.
Neither do I. I don't know that I particularly want to talk about us, either. But that's one thing we have to do.
Eve,
tomorrow. That's why I intend to see you get your rest. Because when we talk about us, I want you to be quite sure you know what you're saying.
Good morning.
What? Oh, good morning. You're early, Inspector. I said 11 o'clock, I think. It's barely 9.
Well, I didn't come for tea this morning, Mrs. Chester. I just wanted to assure your husband of something.
He's still asleep. He was very tired, and I gave him a sedative last night.
I hope he appreciates your solicitude.
Well, I must get back upstairs. I just came down to collect my mail from the box.
You might give Mr. Chester a message for me, will you? It'll save me bothering him.
Yes, what is it?
About the night before last, the police did not make any arrest in Long End Street, not at his flat or outside either.
Oh? All right, then, I'll tell him. Excuse me, Mr. Charlton, I really...
Oh, just a minute.
What?
You forgot to close your letterbox. Shall I close it for you?
Oh, yes, please.
Right. Oh, wait a bit, there's still something here.
Something there? I thought I got all the letters.
No, it's not a letter. It's a slip of paper. Here.
Oh, it'll be some advertising. What on earth?
Something unusual?
Gibberish to me. Some practical joke, I suppose. Here, you may as well read it.
Mike Chester, you won't be needing your pistol. Why not try pawning it again?
What on earth? You don't think... I mean, it's not some kind of threat, is it?
Threat? No, I don't think it's anything like that. Pawnbroker, I seem to remember... Yes, I do. Mrs. Chester, see that your husband gets this note, won't you?
Well, I suppose so, but what does it all mean?
If it means what I think it means, it's most important that he gets it. Oh, and you needn't bother to mention that I know about it.
Well, if this means trouble for
Mike... No, on the contrary, I'm sure he'll be delighted to get the note. And I'll be delighted that he gets it.
All right. I'll give it to him. There's only one thing, Inspector.
Oh, what's that?
I just wish I could be delighted, too.
I'd lost her. Jan Carter, the girl I loved, had disappeared. Had some harm come to her? Had she been arrested? Or had she simply left me of her own accord because she didn't need me after all? Whatever the answer, I knew this couldn't be the end of the affair. Just as I knew that she was too young to die.
You can still see EastEnders on UK TV, but it's long since left our local channels. At its height in New Zealand, the soap opera's theme tune was equally popular. We leave the East End of London for the English countryside to end today. At the manor, Margot and company are discussing holidays. And I hope your holidays go well, Blair Smith of Brindwa, Krista Sparer of Aranui, and the Corbetts of Hornby.
Forbes Hamilton, how nice of you to come. Now you must let me get you a drink. What will you have, a champagne cocktail or a Buck's Whiz?
Oh, a Buck's Whiz, thank you.
Now you must go and talk to Bedrich. But don't let him bore you with that story about lunching with Princess Margaret last week.
He appears to be fully occupied at the moment. Yeah, well, I couldn't do without my feathered friends.
No, I'm sure you couldn't.
I'm particularly fond of badgers. Did you know there was a badger set? In the woods, at the back of the old lodge.
You shouldn't be telling me these things, you know.
Why ever not?
Well, it seems I have a reputation round here. I might turn your badges into shaving brushes and sell them in my store.
According to Audrey... what, Audrey? Morocco's awfully hot, you know. The windows stick and the stamps don't. Where do you go this year, Audrey?
What for?
Holiday, of course. Must have been wretched weather. You're white as a first aid tent.
We had solid sun the whole fortnight.
Ask me, you could do with a spot of sun. Should have come with us. Desert Rats reunion at Sidi Barani.
Was Mr. De Vere there?
He wasn't a desert rat, was he?
I wasn't thinking of the desert bit. No, well, you'll soon know the difference. You see, the chaffinch goes... and the bullfinch goes... Oh, Audrey, you really are looking awfully peaky. You must go on that holiday. We've all had ours, and Mr. De Vere's going on his next week. Is he just? So that only leaves you.
If anyone else tells me I look peaky and need a holiday, I shall scream.
Hello, Audrey.
Hello, Mr. De Vere.
You're looking terribly peaky. You're taking a holiday.
I intend to. Will you excuse me? Well, thank you for the party. It's been really...
Well, you're not off already, are you?
Alas, yes. I have to finish my packing. Goodbye, Mr. Una junta universal.
Una junta universal.
Por favor.
Por favor.
El motor se ha parado.
Se ha parado.
Una junta universal.
Una... I just said that, you silly
Por
man.
Por favor.
Bram, just switch this wretched man off. Oh, blow. There's always something. I've left my sunglasses at home.
Oh, it's all right, madam. I came across them just as you were leaving.
Oh, thank you, Ravendra. What would I do without you? Ravendra, what on earth are you doing in those clothes?
Well, I understood you were on holiday, madam.
So I am, but that's no reason for you to go around looking like a chindit.
But it's well known on the estate that when you are on holiday, I adopt informal dress. Now, if I'd been wearing my working clothes, it would arouse suspicion. And you did say it was to be done properly or not at all.
Of course, Bravendra. Now, did you find out about my flight?
Yes. On the day in question, there was a DC-10 Dan Air flight, number 74632, to Malaga. 2 standby seats available.
Did they tell you anything else about the flight?
Yes, madam. They said you missed it. May I inquire exactly where you are, madam? People are beginning to ask.
I am in Malaga, staying at the Hotel Balmoral. Rather suitable, I thought. I am lying on a sun-drenched beach, looking at a glittering sea, luxuriating in the eternal spring ordained by the ancient gods. And in a moment, I shall be on my way up for lunch of paella and churros, washed down with a glass of Rioja.
Well, it reminds me, madam, your coffee.
Espresso, por favor, camarero.
Espresso?
Yes, all bubbly and frothy, like they have it in Spain.
Si, signora.
That's our cue to leave the air for another month. We're back in a fortnight when it's time to remember Melba's farewell performance. We're on the trail with El Keola, and we join Kenneth Horne, Kenneth Williams, and Betty Marsden for Beyond Our Ken. Take care in the meantime, and hopefully life will be looking up for you. Bye. Out of the Glow is an Ear Media presentation recorded at WebMad Christchurch.